Where the Bodies Are Buried contains graphic depictions of violence that some listeners may find disturbing. Discretion is advised.
Forget what you've heard about serial killers. Forget the movies, podcasts, and stories in the media of infamous psychopaths like Jeffrey Dahmer and Ted Bundy. I'm going to show you what exists beyond all of that, and you will hear from the source, the killers themselves. This is Where the Bodies Are Buried.
That devil is on my side.
My name is Phil Chalmers. For over 35 years, I've dedicated my life to communicating with and studying hundreds of serial killers, teen killers, school shooters, and mass murderers. I help solve cold cases, locate bodies, and bring closure to hurting families of the victim. Joining me is my wife, Wendy, and my producers, Adam and Samantha.
Samantha, you ready?
Yep.
All right, we're rolling.
One, two, all right.
We are about to touch on a very sensitive and controversial subject, teen killers and school shooters. This week, we're going to be speaking to two killers who committed their crimes when they were just teenagers. When he was just 15 years old, Charles Andrew Williams Jr. was responsible for a school shooting at Santana High School back in 2001. And Joshua Cook, who is referred to as the Matrix Killer, was responsible for the killing of both his parents in 2002. Josh claims his addiction to violent video games and the movie The Matrix, combined with being bullied and abused, led him to murdering his parents in cold blood. He says that if that never happened, he may have become a serial killer in the making.
I started dealing with teen killers and school shooters when I was 20 years old. I interviewed over 200 teen killers and school shooters to understand the causes of teen murder, the warning signs that we all should be looking for, and the triggers that create teen killers.
First, we start with Joshua Cook, the Matrix Killer.
19-year-old Joshua Cook brutally gunned down his parents. His motives are currently unknown, but our sources tell us his addictions to violent video games, movies, and music may have played a part.
Joshua Cook, who fatally shot his adoptive parents inside their suburban home, was sentenced to 40 years in prison. The case gathered considerable attention when defense lawyers filed a motion claiming Cook believed he was living in the virtual reality of the science fiction film The Matrix. Cook later entered a guilty plea when lawyers felt their case wouldn't hold up.
The beginning of the episode will be an interview with Joshua Cook, the Matrix Killer. At times, it will be difficult to understand him because of the prison phone.
This call is from an inmate in the Virginia Department of Corrections.
Hey, Josh, how you doing?
Good, man.
Why are you in prison right now?
I've been in prison for 17 years now. I'm in here because I killed my mom and my dad with a shotgun back in 2003. I was 19 years old at the time. I was a ticking time bomb growing up as a teen due to a few underlying factors. I was heavily abused in school. I was heavily bullied. The abuse I suffered was mainly from my mother for years. She would do some things to me and my sister, like just beat us, push our faces into urine, etc. And my father was emotionally absent, and I just hated them both, but especially my mother, and I often fantasized about killing her even at 12 years old. Also, I was heavily impacted by my severe addiction to violent video games and violent media like The Matrix. I was basically raised on those things. I raised myself on those things. My parents, they're my adopted parents. They adopted us. I was 6, my sister was 5. And just 2 weeks after we were adopted into the family, the abuse started from my mother. And she just did like this unrelenting, just sick things to us. And we just hated her from the get-go. And we never had an ounce of love for her. And I don't know what her problem was. She was a woman full of pain, I think. But whatever was going on, she was letting us have it. And so even at 12 years old, you know, I remember talking to my sister in the front driveway of our house. So my sister is my biological sister. And I kind of felt like, what right does she have to do this to us? And so that's where my rage initially started.
Were you inspired by violent video games, violent music or anything like that?
Yeah, absolutely. I was actually listening to a song by Johnny Poole called Bodies, like the Bodies of the Floor song. And in the actual act, at the time, I was actually killing my parents. I had that music on my headphones playing, just blasting in my ears, you know. And with regards to violent video games, I was very much hooked on violent video games like Grand Theft Auto and Doom.
Were you inspired by the Matrix movie?
Yeah, absolutely. Basically, I was obsessed with the Matrix movie. I watched it so many times that I literally wore out the VHS tape. The more I watched it, the more I felt I was taking on the character and the persona of Neo, who is the main protagonist of the movie. It got so bad to the point I felt like I was losing my mind and even started wondering if the Matrix was real. You know, I could just escape the real world by becoming Neo myself. I call it being Neo. I could become Neo, which, by the way, helped me stand up to the bullies in school. I had the matching black clothes and black trench coat Neo wore in the movie. And on the day I committed my murders, I had been watching The Matrix. And the very last thing I did before I committed my crime was to gaze at my life-size Matrix movie poster I had on my wall.
Let's talk about bullying. I mean, this is a major problem that we see in schools all around the world. Can someone really be pushed and bullied to the point of murder?
Bullying is a major problem and is the number one cause of school shootings. I can relate to kids who've been bullied. I experienced a little bit of that growing up myself. And we see now kids will bring guns to school, get revenge on bullies with violence, bloodshed, and murder.
I heard many times that kids' behavior is due to violent games, music, movies. Is that really a factor? I think it's a major issue that nobody really knows the truth to.
It's a very small piece of the puzzle, but it is a piece of the puzzle. You know, I'm not one to say violent video games cause kids to kill. I don't believe that. It's just one of the factors. When I was growing up, we did not blow people's brains out all day long playing video games. So it's a different era we live in, and we're seeing the effects of this, I believe, especially kids that are younger that are playing these video games. Josh, all right, let's walk through your crime.
February 17th, 2003, it was a Monday. I was having dinner with my parents, my mom and dad. And we were sitting at the dinner table and everything was fine. You know, you would never suspect anything. We were just sitting there talking, having a meal together. And then my parents went down to the basement and I went to, I washed the dishes. And when I finished washing the dishes, that's when I went up to my room. And I just sat down on my bed with my black clothes. I put my black coat on, looked up at the Matrix poster, and I grabbed my 12-gauge shotgun and I went downstairs. When I got down to the bottom of the staircase at the basement, my mother was there next to the computer. She turned around. She had a smile on her face. She didn't know what was happening. And I pointed the gun at her. I shot her in the chest. My father was sitting on the other side of the basement. He dove under a table. And I crouched down and emptied a few shots into him. And I had the Johnny Poole Body song playing on my headphones this whole time. I went upstairs to reload, and when I came back downstairs, I was standing at the top of the basement staircase. My mother was standing at the bottom, bleeding out from her chest, and she just looked up at me, and she said, Joshua, what are you doing? And I ended up shotgun at her face, and she just looked at me, and she said, you wouldn't. And I pulled the trigger. I went upstairs, I picked up the phone to call the police, and I grabbed a Coca-Cola from the refrigerator and I drank it as I waited for the police to come get me.
How long did you plan this?
It's funny when people ask me that question because I didn't even know. All I knew was I was on the verge and I knew I could explode any moment and that my parents were probably going to be the receivers of that rage. And it was just like an any moment type of thing. But I bought the gun just a few days before I committed the crime from a sporting goods store.
Did you have any warning signs? Anything people should have seen?
Absolutely, man. And that's a big deal. People need to pay attention. And not just with my parents, but school. You know, I had a fascination with mass shooters, school shooters, because I was heavily bullied and I wanted to emulate them. You know, like the Columbine shooters, they were like gods. They were like gods to me, for real. They were my heroes because they were like my fellow bullies. bullied, you know, friends. And so I felt like I was one of them. And I used to dream about going into their school with my black trench coat on, like, you know, and just in like the Columbine shooters and just shoot up the whole school. But when it comes to my parents, this is kind of hard to talk about sometimes, you know. But I think that is. I'm sorry, Phil.
That's all right.
Yeah, I kind of lost track, you know, thinking about my parents. Every day that goes by, all I think about what I did, my parents come to me in my dreams, you know, it haunts me. My mother will come to me, so like her face will be healed up from where I shot her. Like there'll be lines in her face so that I can see like a puzzle piece, like somebody put her back together piece by piece. And she'll just look at me and she'll just say, "I forgive you."
This is just really hard to listen to. I have mixed feelings. I mean, I feel terrible that a child has to go through all of this, but then again, a killer is a killer.
There were a lot of details they didn't talk about in this interview where his parents were begging for their lives. The father was actually on the phone with his sister. She heard this all happen. It's a multiple cause crime. So we can't just say if you play violent video games, you're going to be a school shooter, or if you come from poverty, or you come from a dysfunctional home. In my opinion, it takes about 3 to 6 causes to create a teen killer. When you put enough of these causes together, dysfunctional home, abuse, violent video games, bullying, substance abuse, you start stacking all these things up, it's eventually going to explode. And that's what you see with Josh Cook. Josh Cook is adopted. He's being abused. He's into violent entertainment. He's being bullied. He's suicidal. And it's just one thing after another. And this is what we see in these cases where Josh Cook can no longer deal with all these issues and he explodes. He goes up in his room, looks at his poster, puts on his headphones, listens to his violent music. He had been playing violent video games, watching a violent movie, loads up his shotgun, walks downstairs and annihilates his own parents. And when he was done, he grabbed a Coke, sat on the front porch, and called the police. Our next call will be with Charles Andy Williams, the Santana, California school shooter who's responsible for shooting 15 of his fellow students. We will also be talking to Jack Thompson, an expert on video game violence. We're talking about a really tough subject on this episode, teen violence and school shootings. I've spent a lot of time researching this subject. We will talk to Jack Thompson, an expert on video game violence. And lastly, we will be interviewing Charles Andy Williams, who was responsible for a school shooting at Santana High School at the age of 15. We are joined by an expert on video game violence, Jack Thompson. You're an activist, you're an expert on violent video games. What is your take on the connection between violent video games and real life violence?
Well, there are basically three proofs that there is a causal nexus, three categories of proofs. One is the American Psychological Association, as well as others, has repeatedly found that there's a linkage as to one thing causing another between violent video game play and teen aggression. Another category of proofs comes out of Indiana University, Harvard, with MRI studies that show that violent video games actually alter the structures of teenage brains. And the MRIs prove that the violent content impacts both the cognitive control centers of the brain and also the emotion and violence control portions of the brain. The Marjorie Stoneman Douglas shooting by Nicholas Cruz, in which this teenager killed 17, injured 17 more. There is evidence of his video game play up to 18 hours a day, and his games of choice were Call of Duty and Grand Theft Auto.
Jack, what do you say to people that say, you know, I've played video games my whole life and I've never killed anybody?
Not everyone who smokes gets lung cancer. But nobody would seriously suggest that smoking doesn't cause lung cancer in some people. So what we know is that violent video games make everyone who plays them more susceptible to violent behavior, because if you put violent garbage in, you are more likely to get violent or at least more aggressive behavior out.
What could we do to protect children from this form of media?
Well, Phil, as you know, I've been at this a long time, well over a decade. And the reality is there is a law, the truth in advertising laws that are already on the books. And here's how it would work. The video game industry age rates games based upon content, and most notably upon violence. But what we know is they routinely sell, despite promises that they won't, mature-rated video games to kids under the age of 17. They do it in big box stores. They do it more easily through internet sales. For example, go to Grand Theft Auto, any of the offerings of that franchise. You can, without having your age verified or even asked, get that game. So here's the industry saying, well, we'll never knowingly sell an age-restricted game to anyone under that age, when in fact they do. And now we have digital direct downloads to gaming platforms like PlayStation and Xbox with no age verification whatsoever. That's fraudulent and deceptive trade practice. So we don't need a new law. We simply need the willingness of people at the federal and state governmental levels to enforce those laws that are on the books.
Tell us about some of the kids that you know who carried out some of these crimes and they were big, avid gamers.
Sure. I've met Joshua Cook, who killed both his parents, and he was an obsessive watcher of The Matrix and also player of the Grand Theft Auto games. Most notably, as to my experience, I met on death row with Devin Thompson, no relation, who literally trained on Grand Theft Auto to kill three cops. It's heartbreaking to meet these kids, but for their video game consumption would not have done what they did. One of the unintended consequences but benefits of the pandemic is that these teenagers who have for 6 months been doing nothing but playing violent video games and therefore predisposed to do the things that we've been talking about here are thankfully not in school. I can't imagine what's going to happen once we go back to real instruction involving kids who've played on these games for months and months and months. And there's a heightened likelihood of more school shootings because of that.
Wow. We appreciate what you do. Keep fighting the fight. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Phil.
All right, buddy.
Now we talk about every parent across the country's biggest fear, a school shooting. Charles Andrew Williams woke up one morning with the intent to kill as many people as possible. He recounts that day and the 8 months leading up to it, including bullying and being sexually abused. But nothing will ever justify killing two young students and injuring 15 others.
This call is from a correction facility and may be subject to monitoring and recording.
Your real name is Charles Williams, but you go by Andy. Why are you in prison?
I'm in prison because on March 5th, 2001, I stole my dad's pistol and I went to my high school and shot 15 of my classmates. I murdered Brian Zucker and Randy Gordon and attempted to murder Scott Marshall, Travis Tate, Melissa McNulty, Trevor Edwards, Raymond Serrato, Heather Cruz, Barry Gibson, James Jackson, Tristan Saladay, Matthew Heyer, Carla Leva, Tim Estes, and Peter Ruiz.
That day you killed how many people?
Brian Zucker and Randy Gordon.
What was your sentence and what is it today?
Originally it was 50 years to life. I pled guilty when I was 16. I wanted to take responsibility and be accountable. So I was sentenced to 50 years to life, and then in 2013, California amended some of their juvenile justice laws. Because I was 15 when I committed the crime, my sentence was reduced to 25 years to life.
When did you enter the prison system?
Committed the crime in 2001 when I was 15. I was sentenced in August of 2002, and then 2 weeks later was delivered to the California Department of Corrections when I was 16 and entered an adult prison.
16 years old, they sent you to an adult prison.
Yeah. Yeah.
How much did you weigh back then?
When I committed the crime, I was about 5'2", 98 pounds.
So you entered the prison system, which is California, which is one of the worst, at 130 pounds at 16 years old.
Yeah.
Was that as hard and as tough as it sounds?
No, absolutely. And like that, at the time, I had this really fatalistic attitude and thought I needed to punish myself. And so I really thought like all the bad stuff that was happening to me was deserved or my fault.
So did you have to fight? Did you deal with sexual attacks?
I was never like physically sexually assaulted, but people would make comments all the time just like being young. My first week in prison, grown men are showing me how to put knives in my butt. to not get caught with them from the officers. It was a very uncomfortable living situation.
And you sit here now looking at a possible release from prison in the next 4 or 5 years. Is that correct?
About that, yeah. Yes, sir.
And if you are released from prison, where will you go and what will you do?
I have several options. It's only because of mercy that I don't deserve and that I don't have coming. I have family in the San Bernardino County area. Based on like vocational training that I've gotten, I'm certified in construction technology. I've gotten college degrees. I recently got certified as a drug and alcohol counselor.
Were you bullied? And if you were, explain, how were you bullied?
As a kid, it was just me and my dad. And he was discharged from the Army. Like, we bounced around a lot when I was a kid. So I was just constantly moving, constantly having to make friends, and then leaving my friends and then going to another school and then leaving that school and going to another school. And so I had a little bit of stability from the time I was 8 to 13. And then we moved again. By the time we ended up in Santee, I had developed this chameleon personality, right, where it was whoever I was with, that's the person I was. I had no sense of self. I had no identity just because I had no idea who I was. I like had this really unhealthy need for acceptance. I just really needed people to like me because I hated change. I hated being by myself. I was constantly alone because I was always moving and it was really difficult for me to get friends. So we moved to San Diego and immediately I get drawn to the kids that are using drugs and drinking because that was part of my social circle. It's the way rougher crowd than I was used to. I was getting punched down. I was getting called names. Again, I was 5'2", 98 pounds. I had an accent. I would get beat up for that stuff all the time. And it progressed from like name calling to getting socked in the face. And people were like, oh, we're sorry. Like, we slipped. No big deal. I'm not able to defend myself against this. I don't want to leave these guys because these are my only friends. I don't want to be by myself. And this weird catch 22, I was relying on drugs and alcohol to numb the pain. And these guys were my connections for the drugs and alcohol. But a lot of times they were the source for the pain. They were the cure and cause of this dysfunction that I was going through at 14. Right. And I couldn't tell my dad, right, because it was just me and him. And he was constantly at work. My mom, I would see her every now and then. When I was with her, I just wanted to be this bubbly, upbeat kid that she knew. I didn't really want to drop none of my junk in her first step. So it was on me to internalize all this stuff. People would call me names. You faggot, you bitch, you pussy, you coward. I don't want to be these things. But then I started calling myself that. Man, these dudes are talking me in the face. Like, I must be a bitch. I'm not doing something about it. And so I'm hearing it from them, but I'm also getting this internal dialogue with myself. And so it progresses. I always wear the same hooded sweatshirt, and people would throw lit cigarettes in it. We would go to lunch, and people would put salad dressing and stuff on my head. I got pushed into a pool one time in October, so it was really cold outside, fully clothed. And every time I came to the side, people would grab towels, and they would snap me. And so they were snapping with these towels, so I was like in the middle of this pool for what felt like hours, or I'm sure it wasn't that long, but it felt like forever. And everybody's having a good time except for me, like I'm freezing and bleeding. And I got sprayed with lighter fluid and set on fire, and it's just like it was this progression of stuff. And my belief system at the time was, man, I must not be important. Nobody likes me. I don't matter. If I complain to these guys, then they're just going to call me more names. If I say anything to a school administrator, that hasn't been my experience. Like, I don't know what that looks like. So as a 14-year-old, I'm catastrophizing and thinking like, oh, they're going to take these kids aside anyway. I was so completely lost at the time.
Wow.
That I had like zero direction in my life.
These are killers. So I'm not here to say we should feel sorry for them. They committed murder. The sad part about these kids is their brain is not fully developed until their mid-20s. These kids are making adult decisions at the age of 13, 15, 16 years old. The consequences for making these adult decisions are lifelong. Some of them will never, ever be released from prison.
This is a difficult subject. We have seen so many of these kinds of shootings all across the country over the last 30 years. Phil, can you talk to us about what you think the steps are to stop these horrible acts from happening again and again?
I've developed 13 causes of why kids kill. And in my opinion, teen murder and school shootings is a multiple cause crime. It takes, in my opinion, 3 to 6 causes to create a teen killer. Examples are you come from a dysfunctional home, you have no father, you're involved in drugs and alcohol, you're obsessed with violent video games and violent media, you're obsessed with deadly weapons, you're involved in gang activity, suicidal, and it goes like that for about 13 causes. It takes 3 to 6 of those to create a teen killer. Sometimes you only get one warning sign. For example, the Parkland, Florida killer tweeted that he wanted to be a professional school shooter. The warning signs are out there. If we know what we're looking for, we should be able to intercept these kids before they kill and get them help. So you have a 15-year-old brain. You're being bullied, punched, salad dressing poured on your head. You're set on fire. They try to drown you in the pool. Your parents are divorced, so you live with your dad. You're experimenting with drugs and alcohol. Your life is a mess.
That's accurate.
How do you go from there, Andy, to saying, I think I'm going to do a school shooting?
So all this stuff is going on. There's abuse from one of the adults. My best friend's stepdad is abusing us.
Wait a minute. Your friend's stepdad is sexually abusing you, right?
Yeah. Like, I didn't get it as bad as my buddy's stepdad was, but all the bullying is going on from my peers. And then this guy, he's buying like the little group of 14 or 15-year-old kids alcohol and cigarettes and making us kiss them. It was very uncomfortable. So on February 8th, my birthday, one of my best friends from Tornado Palms ended up getting killed. And this is the first death I've ever experienced in my life, right? So I'm really confused. It happened on my birthday. And so I go to my peer group and I'm like, hey guys, like I'm a little bit bummed out right now. Like my friend was just killed. And they laughed at me, man. I remember I was crying in my friend's bedroom and they're like, oh, what a bitch, you freaking sissy. And I'm like, holy smokes, it's true. Nobody cares about me. It's like, nobody cares about my friend. Nobody cares about this. This sucks. That was just this tape that I had playing for a month. Nobody really cares about me, man. So I started idealizing suicide. This is my way out. My life will be better if I'm no longer in it. This is it. I'm just going to kill myself. And I just got to figure out a way to do it. I had been skipping school and back in the day with answering machines, right? Mm-hmm. And so I wouldn't go to school, and then the school would call my dad. And so I would go home before my dad got home and erase the message. But he ended up getting off of work one day early. So when he got home, there was a message saying like, hey, Andy hasn't been here in days. What's going on with your boy? And so my dad takes off of work, drives me to school on March 2nd, and sits me down with the guidance counselor, explains to the guidance counselor, look, man, my boy's got a bunch of bruises on him that he can't explain. When my boy isn't with me, he's with you guys. You guys are responsible for him. And the guidance counselor's like, look, I got 2,000 staff and students here. We can't just watch one kid. And I'm like, shoot, do I not say anything? Do I take a step out and be brave? I was like, you know what, man? I'm going to come clean. I'm going to tell this dude what's going on. Like, he's a guidance counselor. He's an adult in authority. Maybe I'll get a reprieve. This is not working out for me. Something's got to give because I'm getting beat up by everybody. This sucks. And the guy was like, look, man, boys are going to be boys. You need to toughen up. We're going to make it through high school. You got to toughen up. And I was, holy smokes, man, he don't care about me either. Nobody cares about me. Wow. Guidance counselor doesn't care about me. Friends don't care about me. I don't matter to any of these people. This sucks. Nobody cares. And that's all those words were all that's going on in my head, man. Nobody cares. Wow. Nobody cares. So I go to my drama class, and I was a terrible student at the time, so I didn't do my homework. She's like, Andy, you're an idiot. You're no good. You're this. You're so stupid. For racing in front of the entire class. And I'm like, this is a terrible day. Like, this ain't getting no better. I'm embarrassed because my teacher called me all these names. I believe all the names to be true. So we go to lunch, and I'm all fired up, and I'm like, you know what, guys? On Monday morning when I come back to school, I'm going to shoot my drama teacher.
You have 1 minute remaining.
Let me call you back.
Okay. Teen killers and school shooters don't kill without a trigger. Being arrested, being expelled, being dumped by their girlfriend. These are the kind of triggers that cause kids to become killers.
It is tough to listen to this, to how poorly Charles was treated leading up to these murders. But I gotta know, getting to the point where you actually want to kill people, I don't understand. There's a disconnect there.
This guy still sounds like a kid.
We are not condoning violence, and we are not giving Andy an excuse for what he did. But we know that the human brain is not fully developed, at least until the early 20s, and most experts say mid-20s. Charles Andy Williams actually thought two things would happen that day when he took his father's revolver to school. He was going to die, either at his own hands or the hands of police. Or number two, he thought that when he carried out this violent crime, he would be back in school next year with the respect of his fellow students. We're going to finish up our conversation with Charles Andy Williams as he walks us through his violent school shooting that changed his life forever, as well as the lives of his fellow students. We're talking to Charles Andrew Williams. So far, he's told us about what factors he feels led him to commit his terrible crimes. And soon, he will be telling us about that horrible day, March 5th, 2001, when two innocent children lost their lives at Santana High School. But first, we are speaking with Dr. Beth Creel, a certified grief counselor specializing in PTSD, death, and loss. She is giving her expert opinion on our interview with school shooter Charles Andy Williams. Hi, Beth. Thank you for talking with me. First, give us your official title.
I'm a certified grief recovery specialist. which means that we deal with individuals that are getting over trauma and loss, and we deal with death.
What was your impression after listening to Charles Andy Williams?
The first thing that I thought was, wow, he really needs to talk. And then as the interview was going on, he was talking about how it was important for him to know all the victims' names, because this was a way for him to almost have a connection with them and their families and feel a certain sense of compassion as to what he did. I felt that his anxiety was really quite all over the place. At 15, which are incredibly formidable years for both male and female children, there was instability in his state of mind. He said that at one point, if I'm not mistaken, he said he had low self-esteem. He started off by answering questions, and then he was almost vomiting information. To me, that's a sign of anxiety. I question what his life was like growing up. Did he live his whole life in this possibly depressed state? Because the average child that gets bullied is not turning into a school shooter. I always wonder when a mother is absent. Individuals have a very difficult time when there's been neglect in early childhood. And I wondered about that neglect. He also spoke about his father and how his father was in the military, so they moved around a lot. So I questioned what his attachment was like to other people. Did he live his whole life in this possibly depressed state? Because the average child that gets bullied is not turning into a school shooter. We have to look at what their life was like. And I'm not using this as an excuse. There's no excuse here for his behavior. But it's interesting to go back in time and see where something went wrong. I think at some point he felt neglected. Possibly this is why he was attached to the kids that were involved in drugs, bad behavior. This was the only attachment that he was familiar with. And so there was a false attachment there. Does this turn around and make somebody want to do some kind of a school shooting? The answer is possibly. There's a theory called learned helplessness. And learned helplessness is very interesting because a lot of times learned helplessness can turn into victimization. He learned in life to play a helpless role because time after time you've been introduced to trauma. So you have this feeling of, woe is me. There's always going to be a shoe that's going to drop. It's always been bad in my life. So when somebody has a learned helpless mentality, they see things always, every time, everything, woe is me. He said this continuously throughout the interview. Nobody was listening to him. Nobody cared. Nobody bothered to find out how he felt. So I think that this really fed into the learned helplessness, and therefore he's going to take out his victimization on other people.
What are your thoughts on bullying being one of the causes of violent behavior?
Bullied, and if it started in the home, and then he was bullied by friends. There's a very interesting comment. Those that get bullied, bully. And those that get hurt, hurt. He ended up doing the ultimate bullying, which is killing. And he also told people. So he was preparing people. I mean, he told people, hey, I'm going to do this, which is a form of bullying in and of itself as well. It's questions like these you want to ask yourself, because then do we give birth to a school shooter? And can we avoid this?
Beth, thank you for your insights and for taking the time to talk to us. Let's hope someday we can stop this.
No problem, and good luck with this.
Now, for the rest of my interview with Charles Andy Williams.
This call is from a correction facility and may be subject to monitoring and recording.
Andy, tell us about that horrible day, March 5th, 2001.
Yeah, no, I told my friends at lunch on Monday morning when I come back to school, I'm going to shoot my drama teacher. Like, I meant it like real cavalier and really flippant and with zero intention. Whatever, Andy, like, you're a big old bitch, bro. You're not going to do anything. You're a big old pussy. And I'm like, no, dude, like, I'm going to show you guys. It's not okay to talk to me like that. So very half-hearted, and I didn't really think anything of it. But then once that seed was planted, man, it was almost as if I started obsessing about it. No, this is a solution. If I do this, everybody will leave me alone. If I do this and the police respond, they'll kill me and everything will be better, right? And so all through the weekend, man, I start telling my friends start telling people, we had a bonfire on Saturday night, and we told everybody at the bonfire, like, hey, don't go to school, because on Monday, Andy's going to do this. And the vast majority of my peers were like, if you do it, shoot this person, or go to this hallway and shoot these people. And I remember thinking, nobody cares. Why is it that nobody told me that this is a terrible idea, and that they should stop me? Right, so the weekend goes by. Monday morning, I wake up. It was weird, man. I remember when I woke up, I was like, I'm going to die today. That's just the way it is. And so I go through the normal morning routine. I steal my dad's pistol. My friend came over. I left a suicide note on top of the stereo, and it was lyrics to the song In the End. No matter what I do, it doesn't matter, because in the end, that's what matters. And that's like all that I kept telling myself is I tried so hard, man, and my life never got any better. And so I put the pistol in my backpack. Me and my buddy, we go to school, and we're hanging out with these friends outside the school, and all these people know about it, right? They're like, oh, Andy, you're going to do this right now? And I'm like, yeah. And one of my buddies half-heartedly passed me down. Nobody says anything. Nobody tells me not to do it. Nobody says, maybe you should reconsider. And I'm like, oh, nobody cares. This is a very serious thing is about to happen, right? And nobody cares. And it was just really surreal to me. And so when I walk onto the campus with my friend, I go to the boys' bathroom, and I'm sitting in the stall. I get the pistol out. I'm holding the pistol in my mouth. And I'm thinking, if I can find a pain-free way to kill myself, that's what I want to do. I don't want to go through this. I don't want to hurt anybody. But I don't want to hurt anymore either. The last 8 months of my life has been nothing but pain, and so I don't want my last act on earth to be painful. And so I threw a blanket statement over the entire school. It was just a generalization. I was like, no, you know what? They made me hurt when I was going to this school, so it's okay for me to hurt them. I felt like nothing when I was here, so it's okay for me to make them feel like nothing. I'm going to matter, man. And so I remember I opened up the restroom door, and two people I knew were standing in front of me, so I shut the door and I sat back on. And I remember thinking, if I don't do this, the bullying's going to get worse. Everybody knows about it. If I don't do this, the people are just going to keep picking on me. Like my life isn't getting any better. Committing this crime, committing this shooting was somehow a solution to all the stuff that was going on with me. And so I opened the door and I started shooting my classmates. I thought if I didn't die, my life would get better. I thought if I didn't die, my classmates would leave me alone. I could return to school as a sophomore and everybody would just leave me be.
You had no idea the consequences would be much greater than that, right?
I didn't.
You had said the authorities reported that over 70 people knew you were going to do a school shooting on Monday.
That is true, yeah. Between, like, the bonfires and all my buddies saying stuff.
And Andy, you had no real targets. When you opened fire, you were shooting the whole school. Everybody in the school was your target, right?
Yeah, it was just a complete blanket statement. Even though they had nothing to do with going on with me, they were still them. And it was completely unfair.
What's that like when you start shooting?
I think the best word to describe it is numb. I had this goal in mind of proving to my classmates that I should have been left alone and thinking that this was the means to that end. If I commit this crime, then I'm somehow going to be left alone. Either way, if the cops come in right now and they kill me, I'm going to have relief from the bullying. Like, if I go through with this, then people are going to leave me alone, which is what I thought. And I'm going to get relief for it.
If you were released today, would you kill again?
No, never, ever, ever. No, like my life today is dedicated to being a person that shows amends through their words and their actions.
Serial killers are not remorseful at all. They laugh when I ask them if they're remorseful. Are you remorseful?
Absolutely, man. It's my responsibility to learn about the ripple effect and the harm that I cause. That's why I try to use the names of the people that I harmed, because it's not lost on me the devastation that I caused them and their families or my community. Like, I am so, so sorry for the harm that I caused.
Well, listen, man, we'll continue to partner to try to stop more of these incidents. And thanks so much for taking the time today. Stay in touch.
Yes, sir.
We've talked about some of the causes of teen murder in this episode, but I want to talk about some of the warning signs that parents can be aware of. The first three are cruelty to animals, fire starting, and wetting the bed as a teenager. Killing and torturing animals is the worst thing a child can do. Jeffrey Dahmer, BTK, and others have started out by killing animals. Kids that make violent drawings in art class, that's a warning sign. Students that pose with weapons on social media. Someone making threats of murder. Someone who's obsessed with deadly weapons, guns, bombs, knives. People who are obsessed with violent entertainment, violent pornography, are all warning signs. Teen killers and school shooters don't kill without a trigger. A trigger could be being expelled or suspended from school, arrested, a dispute with parents over cell phones or curfew, being bullied at school, parents saying you can't date that person, Just because your child displays these signs doesn't mean that he or she is going to be a killer. But it is a warning sign so that you can at least try to get them help before it's too late. This episode was very difficult subject matter for all of us. On this podcast, we are not fans of true crime. We are here to educate our audience so that we can do our best to stop these horrific acts from happening again. If you know of or have a reason to believe someone is planning on committing a crime like Charles Annie Williams or Joshua Cook, do not hesitate to call the police. You can always remain anonymous, and you may save innocent lives. We want to dedicate this episode to all the innocent children that have lost their lives at the hands of school shooters. We will never forget the pain that those families have experienced, and we are going to do our best to stop as many of these crimes as possible. This podcast is produced by Grinning Dog Entertainment and Audio Up. If you want an up-close and personal experience with serial killers that you can't get anywhere else, visit myfriendsaremonstersfanclub.com and join my fan club.